Well, hello, and welcome to our continuation of this chapter in Sri Aurobindo's The Life Divine. This is Chapter 13, Exclusive Concentration of Consciousness Force and the Ignorance. He has been describing how it is a necessity for the consciousness of the divine to compress itself, to concentrate itself, in order to achieve universal manifestation. So if we think of this action of concentration as something that chit-shakti, the conscious being with its power aspect, based in knowledge, attempts to do and achieves, it first has this capacity for concentration within itself as an essence. It can be wholly absorbed in that. And then, of course, it can be an integral concentration, which is everything ranging from the superconscient into the inconscient. And then there is a concentration where it focuses on the multiple, on the multitude. And that, of course, could be followed by the concentration on the separative, on the individual, as distinguished from the many. So these four modes of concentration are there, and they apply to our being in time and obviously our being outside of time. But what are we really, and where are we factually, depends upon which poise we take. So Sri Aurobindo was beginning to discuss the nature of the concentration applicable to our situation when we last broke off. So let's look beyond and from his description of the superficial consciousness of man more deeply into the issue. And we continue with his argument with this paragraph. There is a minor pragmatic use of exclusive concentration on the surface, which may also give us an indication in spite of its temporary character. The superficial man, living from moment to moment, plays, as it were, several parts in his present life, and while he is busy with each part, he is capable of an exclusive concentration, an absorption in it, by which he forgets the rest of himself, puts it behind him for the moment, is to that extent self-oblivious. The man is, for the moment, the actor, the poet, the soldier, or whatever else he may have been constituted and formed into by some peculiar and characteristic action of his force of being, his tapas, his past conscious energy, and by the action which develops from it. So clearly he's here deriving an analogy between the personal and the cosmic. If he's described how it is that concentration applies to the larger realm of being from the transcendent into the universal, here he describes how we in our own being can concentrate on a particular aspect or facet of our personality to the exclusion of all else, at least apparently so. And this too is us exercising tapas, the power of concentration, which is an extension of chit shakti, even into the apparent ignorance. Pardon me. Not only, he writes, is he apt to deliver himself up to this exclusive concentration in a part of himself for the time being, but his success in the action very largely depends on the completeness with which he can thus put aside the rest of himself and live only in his immediate work. Yet all the time, we can see that it is the whole man who is really doing the action and not merely this particular part of him. what he does, the way he does it, the elements he brings into it, the stamp he gives to his work depends on his whole character, mind, information, genius, all that the past of him has made him. And not his past in this life only, but in other lives, and again, not only his past, but the past, the present, and the predestined future, both of himself and the world around him, are the determinants of his work. So this is a contextual determinism that he describes here in something that is self-willed in concert with the larger reality. So if determinism exists, it is by consent that we participate in it. And you can see that how he's described us bears apt analogy or comparison with how the universe works, how the divine works in manifesting and shaping the universe. He continues, the present actor, poet, or soldier in him is only a separative determination of his tapas. It is his force of being organized for a particular kind of action of its energy, a separative movement of tapas which is able, and this ability is not a weakness, a deficiency, but a great power of the consciousness to absorb itself in that particular working to the temporary self-oblivion of the rest of itself, even though that rest is present all the time at the back of the consciousness and in the work itself, and is active or has its influence in the shaping of the work. This active self-oblivion of the man in his work and the part he plays differs from the other, the deeper self-oblivion, in that the wall of separation is less phenomenally and not at all enduringly complete. The mind can dissolve its concentration and go back from its work at any time to the consciousness of the larger self, of which this was a partial action. The superficial or apparent man cannot so go back at will to the real man within him. He can only do it to some extent abnormally or supernormally in exceptional conditions of his mentality, or more permanently and completely as the fruit of a long and arduous self-training, self-deepening, self-heightening, self-expansion. So, in our waking life, we may focus on something with rather completeness and achieve the end of our intention, but it is more difficult for us to break through and get back to the essence of our being, except when we take it as an aspect of dedication, that we commit ourselves to this kind of self-training that he describes here, which allows us to go deep within, to invade the vast around, to expand and to heighten all at once. And this is, of course, the practice of yoga. Still, he can go back. Therefore, the difference is phenomenal only, not essential. It is, in essence, in both cases, the same movement of exclusive concentration, of absorption in a particular aspect of himself, action, movement of force, though with different circumstances and another manner of working. So this is the connotation that this kind of concentration of which we are capable permits us to ignore part of our being in the accomplishment of that objective. And it is not absent our intention to do that. It is not something foisted upon us. It is something that we choose to do. This power of exclusive concentration is not confined to absorption in a particular character or type of working of one's larger self, but extends to a complete self-forgetfulness in the particular action in which we happen at the moment to be engaged. The actor, in moments of great intensity, forgets that he is an actor and becomes the part that he is playing on the stage. Not that he really thinks himself Rama or Ravana, but that he identifies himself for the time being with a form of character and action which the name represents, and so completely as to forget the real man who is playing it. So the poet forgets himself, the man, the worker, and his work, and is for the moment only the inspired, impersonal energy which works itself out in formation of word and rhythm. Of all else, he is oblivious. The soldier forgets himself in the act, and becomes the charge and the fury and the slain. In the same way, the man who is overcome by intense anger forgets himself, as it is commonly said, or as it has been still more aptly and forcibly put, becomes anger. And these terms express a real truth, which is not the whole truth of the man's being at the time, but a practical fact of his conscious energy in action. If I may just parenthetically insert here that there is, of course, that great example of Sri Ramakrishna, who even as a child, undertaking the role of Krishna, the role of Rama in some local pageant, would become that being. And this is a signature, in fact, of how we bring myth into reality, that in the form, the consciousness that signifies that form takes over the being, and one becomes that. Chaitanya, ordinarily just a great devotee of Krishna, would, in moments when he took up the role, become Krishna himself. So it is possible for that higher influence to lean itself into the form, but that is not what Sri Aurobindo is speaking about here. But I dare to mention it simply because Ramakrishna and Chaitanya mean so much to us. He does forget himself, Sri Aurobindo continues, forgets all the rest of himself with its other impulses and powers of self-restraint and self-direction, so that he acts simply as the energy of the passion which preoccupies him, becomes that energy for the time being. This is as far as self-forgetfulness can go in the normal active human psychology, for it must return soon to the wider self-aware consciousness of which this self-forgetfulness is only a temporary movement. But in the larger universal consciousness, there must be a power of carrying this movement to its absolute point, to the greatest extreme possible for any relative movement to reach. And this point is reached not in human unconsciousness, which is not abiding and always refers back to the awakened conscious being that man normally and characteristically is, but in the inconscience of material nature. So here he is moving from the personal analogy back to the cosmic picture. This inconscience is no more real than the ignorance of exclusive concentration in our temporary being, which limits the waking consciousness of man. For, as in us, so in the atom, the metal, the plant, in every form of material nature, in every energy of material nature, there is, we know, a secret soul, a secret will, a secret intelligence at work, other than the mute, self-oblivious form. The conscient, conscient, even in unconscious things, of the Upanishad, without whose presence and informing conscious force or tapas, no work of nature could be done. And for that, of course, we have many citations in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the Isha Upanishad, the Mandukya Upanishad, etc. What is inconscient there is the prakriti, the formal, the motional action of the energy absorbed in the working, identified with it to such an extent as to be bound in a sort of trance or swoon of concentration, unable to go back while imprisoned in that form to its real self, to the integral conscious being and the integral force of conscious being which it has put behind it, of which, in its ecstatic trance of mere working and energy, it has become oblivious. Prakriti, the executive force, becomes unaware of Purusha, the conscious being, holds him hidden within herself, and becomes again slowly aware only with the emergence of consciousness from this swoon of the inconscience. Purusha indeed consents to assume the apparent form of itself which Prakriti constructs for it. It seems to become the inconscient, the physical being, the vital being, the mental being. But in all these, it remains still in reality itself. The light of the secret conscious being supports and informs the action of the inconscient or emergently conscious energy of nature. While using the dualistic language of the Sankhya philosophy, he has insisted here in a subtle way that there is no ultimate rupture between them, no gulf, that Prakriti, nature, is dwelling in and has the presence constantly of this secret spiritual reality, and that the consciousness of that reality emerges, really emerges, and manifests itself in nature. So there is no division. It is not, in Sri Aurobindo's view, a truth that nature is unconscious. Rather, all is a play of consciousness. The inconscience, he writes, is superficial, like the ignorance of the waking human mind, or the inconscience or subconscience of his sleeping mind, and within it is the all-conscient. It is entirely phenomenal, but it is the complete phenomenon. So complete is it that it is only by an impulsion of evolutionary consciousness emerging into other forms less imprisoned by this inconscient method of working that it can come back to itself, recover in the animal a partial awareness, then in man at his highest some possibility of approach to a first more complete though still superficial initiation of a truly conscious working. But still, as in the case of the superficial and the real man, where there is only a similar though lesser inability, the difference is phenomenal only. Essentially, in the universal order of things, the inconscience of material nature is the same exclusive concentration, the same absorption in the work and the energy, as in the self-limitation of the waking human mind, or the concentration of the self-forgetting mind in its working. It is only that self-limitation carried to a farthest point of self-forgetfulness which becomes not a temporary action, but the law of its action. nescience in nature is the complete self-ignorance. The partial knowledge and general ignorance of man is a partial self-ignorance, marking in her evolutionary order a return towards self-knowledge. But both are, and all ignorance is, when examined, a superficially exclusive, self-forgetful concentration of tapas, of the conscious energy of being, in a particular line or section of its movement, of which alone it is aware, or which alone it seems to be on the surface. So, like and like, as above, so here, as here, so above, as in us, so in nature. All of it the play of tapas, and nescience that laps into complete self-ignorance is an exercise of tapas. The ignorance, he writes, is effective within the bounds of that movement and valid for its purposes, but phenomenal, partial, superficial, not essentially real, not integral. We have to use the word real necessarily in a quite limited and not in its absolute sense, as when we use it to be equatable with sat, the word for existence. For the ignorance is real enough, but it is not the whole truth of our being, and by regarding it by itself, even its truth is misrepresented to our outer awareness. In that true truth of itself, it is an involved consciousness and knowledge evolving back to itself, but it is dynamically effective as an inconscience and an ignorance. Now, I might say that it would be wise for us to put our bookmark here because this ends a certain section in this chapter. But let's go another paragraph forward. This being the root nature of the ignorance, a practical truth of a phenomenally but not really dividing, of a limiting and separative conscious energy absorbed in its works to the apparent forgetfulness of his integral and real self, we may answer the questions that arise of the why, the where, and the how of this movement. So we'll get started, and then we'll interrupt and have to continue next week. The reason for the ignorance, its necessity, becomes clear enough once we have seen that without it, the object of the manifestation of our world would be impossible, could not be done at all, or not completely, or not in the way in which it should be and is done. So he just said that ignorance is necessary so that the design of the world can unfold and reach its goal. Each side of the manifold ignorance has its justification, which is only a part of the one general necessity. Man, living in his timeless being, could not have thrown himself into the stream of time with that movement of subjection to its flux from moment to moment, which is the nature of his present living. So if we were above in the superconscious, we could not have become a creature of the moment, successive moment after successive moment. Living in his superconscious or subliminal self, he could not have worked out from the not of his individual mentality the relations which he has to ravel and unravel with the world about him, or would have to do it in a radically different fashion. Living in the universal self, so now we go from the timeless to the universal, living in the universal self and not in the egoistic separative consciousness, he could not evolve that separate action personality, outlook from himself as the soul or the initial center and point of reference, which is the contribution of the ego sense to the world workings. He has to put on the temporal, the psychological, the egoistic ignorance in order to protect himself against the light of the infinite and the largeness of the universal, so as to develop behind this defense his temporal individuality in the cosmos. So there is a purpose in the individuality that demands this ignorance, this protection from both the transcendent and the universal. He has to live, Sri Aurobindo writes, as if in this one life, and put on the ignorance of his infinite past and his future. For otherwise, if the past were present to him, he could not work out his present selected relations with his environment in the way intended. His knowledge would be too great for him. He would necessarily alter the whole spirit and balance and form of his action. He has to live in the mind, absorbed by this bodily life, and not in the supermind. For otherwise, all these protecting walls of ignorance created by the limiting, dividing, differentiating power of mind would not be built, or would become too thin and transparent for his purpose. So this is as we have determined it, that we would abandon and leave above the superconscience which is native to us, that we would seclude ourselves in this form, that we would invest ourselves in this ignorance and climb out of it to attain a personal and a cosmic purpose. So I know it has been a short evening, but we have too much left in the chapter to accomplish it tonight, and if I go farther, then next week will be unusually short, so we may as well close here. I want to read from you again a passage from Savitri, which reflects on the theme of self-oblivion, which Sri Aurobindo was writing about as we began this evening's study. And I think you'll find that this has relevance for today as well, because today in India, it is the 5th of December, the day in which Sri Aurobindo withdrew from his physical body. And this section is in Book 9, Canto 1, Towards the Black Void. Immediately after Satyavan has left his body, Savitri is sitting with him in the huge wood. Canto 1, Towards the Black Void. So was she left alone in the huge wood, surrounded by a dim, unthinking world, her husband's corpse on her forsaken breast. In her vast, silent spirit, motionless, she measured not her loss with helpless thoughts, nor rent with tears the marble seals of pain. She rose not yet to face the dreadful God. Over the body she loved, her soul leaned out in a great stillness without stir or voice, as if her mind had died with Satyavan. But still the human heart in her beat on, aware still of his being near to hers. Closely she clasped to her the mute lifeless form, as though to guard the oneness they had been, and keep the spirit still within its frame. Then suddenly there came on her the change which in tremendous moments of our lives can overtake sometimes the human soul and hold it up towards its luminous source. The veil is torn, the thinker is no more. Only the spirit sees, and all is known. Then a calm power seated above our brows is seen, unshaken by our thoughts and deeds. Its stillness bears the voices of the world. Immobile, it moves nature, looks on life. It shapes immutably its far-seen ends. Untouched and tranquil amid error and tears, and measureless above our striving wills, its gaze controls the turbulent whirl of things. To mate with the glory it sees, the spirit grows. The voice of life is tuned to infinite sounds. The moments on great wings of lightning come, and godlike thoughts surprise the mind of earth. Into the soul's splendor and intensity, a crescent of miraculous birth is tossed, whose horn of mystery floats in a bright void. As into a heaven of strength and silence thought is ravished, all this living mortal clay is seized, and in a swift and fiery flood of touches shaped by a harmonist unseen. A new sight comes, new voices in us form, a body of the music of the gods. Immortal yearnings without name leap down, large quiverings of godhead seeking run, and weave upon a puissant field of calm a high and lonely ecstasy of will. This, in a moment's depths, was born in her. Now, to the limitless gaze disclosed that sees things barred from human thinking's earthly lids, the spirit who had hidden in nature soared out of his luminous nest within the worlds. Like a vast fire it climbed the skies of night. Thus were the cords of self-oblivion torn. Like one who looks up to far heights, she saw, ancient and strong as on a windless summit, above her where she had worked in her lone mind, laboring apart in a soul tower of self, the source of all which she had seemed or wrought, a power projected into cosmic space, a slow embodiment of the aeonic will, a starry fragment of the eternal truth, the passionate instrument of an unmoved power. A presence was there that filled the listening world. A central all assumed her boundless life. A sovereignty, a silence, and a swiftness. One brooded over abysses, who was she? As in a choric robe of unheard sounds, a force descended, trailing endless lights, linking time's seconds to infinity. Illimitably it girt the earth and her. It sank into her soul, and she was changed. Then, like a thought fulfilled by some great word, that mightiness assumed a symbol form. Her being's spaces quivered with its touch. It covered her as with immortal wings. On its lips the curve of the unuttered truth, a halo of wisdom's lightnings for its crown. It entered the mystic lotus in her head, a thousand-petaled home of power and light. Immortal leader of her mortality, doer of her works and fountain of her words, invulnerable by time, omnipotent, it stood above her, calm, immobile, mute. Let me read to you, if I may, to close our time together on this occasion. the message released today by the Sri Aurobindo Ashram in Pondicherry, 5 December 2016. To express our gratitude to Sri Aurobindo, we can do nothing better than to be a living demonstration of his teaching. The Mother. Namaste. Jai Ma.